Good evening, everyone. And I'm continuing with at least some of these solo webinars. It's going to be a huge effort. And the question is, can we reach the end by 2025? And meanwhile, of course, you know, you're getting a very comprehensive education on all this because Francis Donald is working on The Secret Doctrine, and that is a mammoth work. And also, every other week on the Hidden Wisdom of the Ages, I think it's called something like that. And it's the commentary, his commentary and the group's commentary on Manly Hall's Encyclopedia of Masonic, Rosicrucian, Kabbalistic, and Symbolic Philosophy. A huge book. And if you buy the original, you know, it's really, really big. So we have finished the introduction to A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. And following that, there comes a kind of an outline of what will be covered in the book, the Division A. This is at least the internal fires, right? Division A of the sheaths, macrocosmic and microcosmic, you know, the vehicles of any unit of consciousness. Then Division B, the personality ray and the first fire. These are the elemental lives and the lower Devic lives, which comprise the personality not only of the human being, but of other atoms, other beings. Division C, prana and the etheric body, very important to discuss the latent fire and the radiant fire, the active fire of ether. And then Division D, the Kundalini and the spine. Division E, motion on the physical and astral planes, in the sheaths and in the centers. And then the law of economy. This is very deep material, and as DK says, it's not necessarily the part of the book that will be studied the most. More will be studied in the area of describing what the soul is, and then once again we have the spirit later in a shorter section, and it will not be studied as much because we are focused on that. I'll just read this because it'll give us an idea of the outline of the entire book. The fire of mind or solar fire, the fire that is found on the higher mental plane and to a certain extent within the spiritual triad. So Division A, the nature of manas or mind, I suppose both lower and higher. Division B, manas as a cosmic, systemic, and human factor, because, you know, we're dealing with at least three atoms and maybe four, the solar systemic atom, or the solar logos as an atom. Every planetary logos is an atom, the human being on whatever planet as an atom, and then the actual atom of substance. Division C has to do with the egoic ray, the ray of the soul, and solar fire, and he enlarges upon this constantly in the other books. Just want to make sure, yeah, we're pretty good. And then division, it should be division D, not B, thought elementals and fire elementals. So this has to do with creativity on the plane of mind and the kinds of beings that are operative in that creative process. Division E, motion on the plane of mind. This is a book written on the third ray as well as the first, and the third ray is particularly the ray of movement and motion. So we will probably study rotary motion. spiral cyclic motion and the motion of progress onward, the straight line motion of the will. Division F, the law of attraction, which is fundamental to our solar system, the fifth in order, but the second major solar system. And the law of attraction and the general idea of the love, magnetic love energy, is prominent in this particular solar system. Then section three, some of which is done in video form. I've made 33 videos in the last section, and it's dealing with the spirit, and it's more the first ray section of the book. Division A, certain basic fundamentals. We'll see when we get there. That's when we get there. Division B, the nature of the seven cosmic paths. That's on a video. This is our destiny, and now there are nine cosmic paths, two of which are not described, but we are told they exist. And then the seven esoteric stanzas, and to these seven esoteric stanzas, we will add discussion of the stanzas of Dzogchen. They're a little bit too obscure to take up immediately before we've really read the book, and we will have, once we have read the book, a certain scaffolding, a certain modicum of knowledge, which will help us fill in the highly symbolic teaching in the stanzas of Dzogchen. Again, this is, as I said, on the video, but we'll see, should we get there, we will discuss it. And I also, Makara, I made my notes available. You know, I oftentimes fill in things as we're writing, and I, although it's not the most elegant seventh-ray, fourth-ray presentation, those, what I was thinking at the time, is available. So basically, the above tabulation and of subjects dealt with in this treatise is of very real importance, for it forms the basis of that which we shall be considering. And let's see if that begins. No. The basis of that which we shall be considering. The if The Secret Doctrine is a difficult book, and it is, but a wonderful book, inspiring book, then it is also true of the of this psychological key to the secret doctrine offered in the form of Cosmic Fire, a treatise on cosmic fire. And D.K. Tells us this is a book for initiates. We're not making any claims here, but we're just attempting to learn what we can, and the day may come when we can interpret this book with the initiate consciousness. The total lack of a wider consciousness than the individual and the personal acts as a bar to the true comprehension of things macrocosmic. You know, so many people just aren't interested in that which lies beyond the person and the personal. We see it all the time. You know, their consciousness is simply confined to the obvious self, which is simply instrumental to the real self, which is interior. But if the occult method is adhered to, if the law of correspondences is studied, and if we ever reason upward from the microcosm to the greater whole, often using the law of analogy, right, and the law of correspondences, which is a more detailed form of the law of analogy, then glimpses will be caught of vast realms of realization, and vistas of spiritual unfoldment will open up before us, undreamt of hitherto. Now, I'm not sure who's writing this. Is the Tibetan writing this, or is Alice Bailey writing it? But it's very much like what she described in the introduction, that when she was under the influence of the Tibetan's mind and taking down the his words and thoughts, huge vistas opened up before her that she could never have dreamt of or achieved without his presence. You know, we stand on the shoulders of giants, it is said. I think Newton said it. If he had been so successful as to see more than the average individual, it was because he stood on the shoulders of giants. Well, we'll see who actually said it. I think it was Newton, but let's make sure. Okay, now there are certain tabulations, and these tabulations are available, and they've been color-coded, some of them at least, and we will deal with them as we go along, not necessarily being able to explain every aspect of them, but we will look at the hints that they may give us. Give you an idea here. There is that wonderful, this is an important chart just of the three aspects of divinity, and let's see, but we always have to go back, don't we? Yeah, we always have to go back, and that's a little harder to find, but I can make the attempt to go back. Anyway, I'm not going to open up everyone. We'll get to them as we do. And Tuya has made some wonderful charts of these, and Keith Bailey early on made charts which gave color codes and so forth. Very valuable. I mean, look, we're not going to absorb everything that's in this book. We have to realize that. But at the same time, we may make a try to expand. Where am I going? Treatise, there we go. I somehow managed to go into an altogether different book. Anyway, some of these charts are wonderful, and fire in the aspects, evolution in the universe, the aspects and evolution, the building entities. There's some tabulations, you know, on the creative hierarchies, which are very important. Agni, Lord of Fire, and there are many types of Agni. All you have to do is settle on one of the dimensions in our universe, and it has its own type of Agni, but of course Agni is one. And when we think about Agni, I think one way to think about it is as the personality nature of our solar logos. The lives and their goal. This is wonderful, and gives us a sense of the various evolving beings and how one group evolves into another, and that group into still another, always going higher and higher if things work out right, and then in general energies. So what we have here now is the beginning, definitely, of what the Tibetan has written, and I'll be able to go sort of back and forth. I think what I did do carefully over quite a number of years was to create these compilations for the, well, they're not compilations, they're commentaries, really, for the classes that I was teaching. I think I began to teach Cosmic Fire in 2005. And I think I concluded teaching Cosmic Fire, or did it teach me, in 2000, nine, about 5 years worth of doing that. Of course, that implies and suggests the manus. I don't think we ever, in any of the classes, were able to complete the book. But I did, in my own manner, complete the book, either in written form, which you can see on Makara, makara.us, or in video form toward the very end, where I might have gotten impatient and probably could not see myself being so utterly meticulous in print. So, but still, I think there is some value in it. Now, we've been studying with Francis the secret doctrine, and we know that there are certain fundamentals to it, and D.K. Recapitulates those fundamentals here, and in blue, I pretty much am writing what I think, and if things came up in classes, I used a different color, and I don't see that we will necessarily speak of everything here. It's what the Tibetan says that's most important, but sometimes, you know, in order to kind of crack the code, we need to look at his words in a certain way that will open doors for people, at least give us our foot in the door. It was said by Alice Bailey, I think, that this would be useful for a spiritual generation or for a generation. A generation is generally 20 or 25 years. Well, okay, I hope there was a code to that, because I can see this book even being read by masters and be of value for centuries. Especially what's interesting is every time a new bridging treatise is written, it throws increasing light on the treatises written before. So with the coming of the third installment, we'll learn even more about the second and the first, just as with the coming of the Alice Bailey second installment for 30 years, we learned more about the secret doctrine, which was his first attempt at inspiring a bridging treatise under the able mind and will of H.P. Blavatsky. Yeah, we learned still more and what the limitations were in that first presentation. For instance, when describing planetary manifestation, the word chain was used, but not the word scheme. And the scheme is composed of seven chains. And the seven, there may be even more of a subtle nature, maybe 10, maybe 12. There are many hidden factors having to do with the planet, and there is a kind of superimposition that may be occurring when we think of these different globes and chains. It's not that they're all necessarily spread out in space. That is still not dealt with. But they are separated from each other by the quality and the frequency of their vibrations. So they are, in a way, separate areas, separate spheres. And we will work on that. I would prefer to have 10 years to do this rather than 5 before the end of the era of the Forerunner, 5.5 years roughly. But we cannot rush, because we have to understand, and it's definitely going to expand our mind for sure and bring us toward that part of the spiritual triad which is called the abstract mind. And meanwhile, of course, the concrete mind will get quite a workout as well. So this is called Introductory Postulates, and maybe I should have kind of a, you know, one of these. Okay. And in a certain color. And maybe that color has to be purplish. I think. And let's go up to 11 instead of 10. Okay. The teaching which is given in this treatise on cosmic fire might be formulated in the following terms. These postulates are simply extensions of the three fundamentals to be found in the proem in the first volume of the Secret Doctrine by H.P. Blavatsky. And in that proem, she says some pretty unconventional things, things that the average reader might not be able to grasp. They are deeply metaphysical, and we notice that he is extending what is said there. He says so. Students are recommended to study them carefully. In this way, their understanding of the treatise, this treatise, will be greatly aided. We certainly, you know, need the foundation, don't we? And if we don't have the foundation, we cannot build soundly, and thus it goes for the mind and consciousness. So in the proem was dealt with recently in Francis's class, and, you know, I just leave that to him and what emerged there. So, you know, beginning at the beginning as we are, we want to be on firm and steady ground. And a fourth fundamental is said to be emerging. Some people have thought that they are presenting that fourth fundamental. It has to do, I think, with psychology. It has to do somewhat with astrology. And we do not yet know whether that fourth fundamental has been truly formulated. But the valiant attempt has been made, because he predicted that an individual or an initiate would appear who would formulate it. But presumption may also be present as we try to fulfill what D.K. predicts. You know, the whole question of who is this new amanuensis, there are many applicants, and some of them, you know, at the turn of the century with pen in hand, if you know what I mean. So a lot of humility is required, and many able minds try to deal with this material, but we have to discriminate as students of the material whether what is said, good as it is, could come from the writer himself or herself, or whether the presence of the master would be required, given the kind of material it is. Now, in such a foundational book as Initiation, Human and Solar, and, you know, said to be, what, one of the easier books, what I am realizing always is that without the knowledge and presence of the master, that book could not have been written. It just contains arcane information which is just absolutely beyond what the normal human being will know. So the first postulate here, there is one, only one, boundless, boundless immutable principle, one absolute reality which antecedes all manifested, conditioned being. It is beyond the range and reach of any human thought or expression. Well, maybe we should, you know, just give up right there. But If we decide upon what a thing is not, we come closer to intuiting what it is, and we don't fall into traps that convince us that we have, with the concrete mind, discovered what it is. There is one boundless, immutable principle, one absolute reality. Sometimes we call it the absolute, absoluteness. In my book, Infinitization of Selfhood, I think I have 241 names for this no thing, including the no thing. So right there, I've kind of violated the first principle, but it's all a variety of the idea of neti neti, not this, not that. And if we can dismiss what some people think it is, by sheer negation, we come closer, closer, ever closer to what it really is. And of course, finally, we are that. So basically, DK is saying, you know, we can't even think of what this boundless, immutable principle, this absolute reality, this absoluteness is. I tend to write about it in full capital letters as being, in a way, extra-universal. In other words, the universe could disappear, any universe could disappear, and still it exists. And when I'm writing about that which occurs within any universe, I tend to use capital letters only in the beginning of words. And then when I'm writing about ordinary perceptions within a universe, of which there have been infinitudinous, so there's no number on that, or at least no definite, definite number, such as you say, well, this is the trillionth, this is the trillionth and one universe. We can't do that because it has no beginning and no end. So when I've written about that, I've tried to emphasize various aspects, and in the book Infinitization, if you can stand it, a few people have stood it. you know, if it falls off the shelf and hits you on the head, maybe you'll know it's meant for you. And we joke that this is a book that opens doors and keeps them open. It makes a very good door holder. You know, it's a heavy book. And maybe complete readers can be found on one hand. I don't know. But there are a few. And I have not seen them go mad or insane or anything like that. And I've seen maybe improvement even in their way of using consciousness and expanding consciousness. So we can't think of it, but we're compelled to think of it. The philosopher, theologian Paul Tillich, you know, back 50 years ago or more, he called it the ground of all being. And it's absolutely homogeneous. You know, if you really want to get more into it, pick up what is written in the Identify as Being series of videos and written documents and recordings of webinars and things like that, because we deal very much with this principle of being. We just know that it is boundless. And in a way, you know, you cannot say it stretches so many light years or something like that, because that would imply a boundary. So it's infinite and immutable, we're told, and that therein some problems are presented, because out of it comes all of mutability, without changing the immutability of it. And how can that be? Apparently it is. So it is forever changeless. Well, some people look at changelessness as a very dull situation, and they think it's static and it's not interesting and it's not living and all the rest of it. But from my point of view, it's so utterly intense, utter. I like the word utter because it somehow expresses an absolute unfoldment, or, well, it's not even that. You know, words are problematic. But it expresses a certain absoluteness beyond which you cannot go, because it is so absolutely utter. Absolutely utter. And I just can put that in, you know. Absolutely utter. I'm keeping the original the way it is, and this will be, okay, this is strange, there we go, okay, so we can't think of it, we can't speak of it, you know, but we do, call it by many names. It was 241 names that I devised for this. I just kept going. Well, it's probably the absolute opposite of what anybody can do, and yet it has no name, and yet it absolutely is. Absolutely is. The Nameless One. And we can't even, well, we can say that. Anything you predicate, attribute to this no thing, is never worked out or appearing in an articulated, distinct manner within the no-thing as the no-thing. When illusion arises, that's the only word I can think of at the moment, arises from this no-thing, which is the root of everything, then we have all the articulation, then we have all the absolutely infinite difference. This is no thing. We can call it Venus. I think that's one of HPB's names for it. It's just as long as we don't think of it as a definite, limited being with other beings existing within it. It's absolutely homogeneous, which doesn't mean that something articulate or some lumpy thing has been homogenized. It's just utter substandingness, changeless perfection. I can even call, if I dare say this, utterness. Do I dare say that? Okay, maybe. So, utterness. I like that. Obviously, maybe if we knew more of Sanskrit, and I have tried quite devotedly, really. We could find more of what it is or isn't. But we'll never be able to, as human beings, put it in thought. And I have a little theory that as our universal logos, or any universal logos, ends up being an absolute infinitesimal, dimensionless, when compared with absolute infinitude, that even the greatest of beings, as we consider them great, cannot fathom what it really is in the post-pralayic state, in the supra-universal state, you know, once the universe, any universe, has dissolved or has collapsed into the absolute infinitesimal and then been reabsorbed into absolute infinitude, with, of course, not ever having left absolute infinitude. That's the funny thing about illusion. It's the strange thing about the monad. The monad stays at home, and yet it goes forth. The content, illusory content and form of a universe is always an aspect of absolute infinitude, and yet it goes forth into relative isolation within a universe, and as an illusory something. So it stays in the supra-universal world, which is, in my view, kind of the world between absoluteness and universal Mahamaya. See, there's sort of three levels there, as I conceive it, and who's to say? I just can do the best I can, you know, in terms of the conception. There's absoluteness, and there's that which arises from absoluteness, which is the absolute deity, and its homogeneous self-reflection, and its absolutely infinitely articulated self-reflection. That's sort of world number two. And then world number three is the universal logos and whatever kind of articulation or emanation comes out of this universal logos. That's the one, two, three of it as I conceive it. So, utter utterness, changeless perfection. I mean, the minute we try to get a fix on things, we've sort of finitized it. We've kind of thinged it, if I can use a funny word. We say, hey, wait, it's gone on long enough. It's, you know, and then we try to grasp it. No. But in a way, the only way you know that there is space is if there is a boundary to space. So this something, in a way, this beingness does not have extension. You know, we perceive with extension, we perceive what we call space between things and objects which take a certain amount of the space around us in our perceptual field. Like if I hold up this little thing here, and I think I've done some horrible thing to it. No. If I hold this up, it's a lot smaller than my computer. It's occupying a lot less of what we call space than the computer is. But that turns out to be illusory, and when we think of absoluteness, you need something else in order to measure another thing against it, and there is no other thing. So in a way, the whole idea that it's extended forever kind of implies that there would be something you could measure its extension against. And I think that the truth of the matter, it's absolutely non-extended, and there is no space as we consider space, as we usually consider space. And sometimes in this kind of teaching, a word like all capitals, S-P-A-C-E, is used to describe what this is. I think Manly Hall used that in one of his philosophy books. You open it and it's a black page, nothing there, and he calls it space. But space usually means the space between, and there is nothing that you can talk about as being between. There's nothing else. So therefore, in my view, this reality, although it's hard to conceive, has no extension at all. And it's only in the realm of illusion, either the kind of supra-illusion that exists in the second world of the Absolute Deity, or the third level, or the universal illusion. It's only there that we begin to get space. But there's a lot of paradoxes. I've even called this thing, or thingless, this no thing, the ultimate paradox. Because it seems to be infinite and finite at the same time, and if it is to be what it is, then the finite has to exist, because nothing, infinitude, absolute infinitude, contains all possibility acted out, including the creation of that which is finite. So within this supra-universal world, the finite also exists, as well as infinite series, which are of things or numbers, which are realized, not just hinted at. In our limited universe, you cannot complete an infinite series. You can only say it exists, but you don't have the real thing. You don't have the actual fullness of an infinite series. But in the supra-universal world, you do. So, you know, this is bending our minds in ways that give us an appreciation of why he says it's beyond the range and reach of any human thought or expression, and I've explained that I think it's beyond the range and reach of the thought of any being within a cosmos, including the greatest being in the cosmos, that turns out to be, when compared to absolute infinity, absolute infinitesimal, always smaller than anything that is definite, however small it is. If it's definite, this absolute infinitesimal is always smaller. And we know there's no end to the ability to conceive a definite tininess and division. That doesn't mean, of course, that this kind of tininess actually exists in a universe, because I think that the universal logos calls it, sets limits, and does not allow for the absolutely infinite division of anything in a universe. The ultimate particle event that I kind of talk about in my infinity book, in Infinitization, has a certain scope, a certain magnitude. Even if that's not its final magnitude once it collapses. You have to collapse every universe so that it can disappear according to the law of cyclicity, or the great breath, or the law of periodicity applied on those high levels. So this whatever it is by its very nature paradox. It's everything and nothing. Because it's the no thing. Now, the no thing doesn't mean a complete vacuity, in my view anyway. It doesn't mean something that is not, like zero, or like zero isn't. This simply indicates the impossibility of any concrete, delimited, bounded thing or state or energy existing within the absoluteness per se. In other words, when there's only absoluteness, and it's an interval between universes, and even the actor, the absolute deity who sees himself and therefore knows himself to be infinite or knows itself to be infinite, when all that's gone, then there's no possibility within absoluteness that some kind of articulated, bounded something, like, you know, granulated, as it were, is existing within the absoluteness in its pure state. The universe is not the pure state of the absoluteness, and neither, as far as I'm concerned, is the world of the absolute deity, who is an actor and a perceiver. As a matter of fact, there's no, as I see it, there's no perception, no self-perception within the absoluteness. The absoluteness just has such utter utterness, or is such utter utterness, that all those things like self-perception and intelligence and division and color and, you know, all the things that make up what we're familiar with in this universe, they're not necessary, because the utter utterness is forever all of them. Now, how that can be, I just put it out as a hypothesis, that the utter utterness of the absoluteness is essentially everything that can ever appear in objectivity, including the kind of objectivity that exists for the absolute deity, you know, one step reduced from absoluteness, who sees itself as absolute infinitude, but an articulated absolute infinitude. It sees its homogeneity, yes. Maybe it experiences itself as homogeneity, yes. But it also sees itself in absolutely infinite articulation. So, you know, these are words. And if they give a little hint, then so be it. They may indicate something that will bring a flash of greater realization in our consciousness than we now have. The supreme mystery, however, it is the supreme mystery because it is utterly utter. I've hit upon this utterness, you know, utterly utter. Utterly utter. This is a way of being vague and yet perhaps more accurate than if we start to give more concretized names. We call it, the amazing thing is, I say here, that we, whatever we think we are, we are it. There's nothing else but it. So when you look around you and use whatever sense, high or low, for registration, all that you think you are and all that seems to exist in distinction around you is it. You're it. Like the kids when they play their hide-and-seek game. So, I've changed some ideas about infinitization from infinitization of selfhood. I do deal with the matter exhaustively. I say, well, at least it exhausted me. I wrote this from, I think, 1994 to 1996. Or was it 96 to 98? I'll have to check the front of the book. I know I wrote it when my progress moon was in Capricorn. And that's coming again for me. So at least I had a relatively, for myself, you know, not making any claims for it, relatively panoramic vision. At least I went as high as I could go and then after that point had to descend and make things practical and get back into the second-rate teaching and do what was required. Some things came up in class, some questions. Oh, shall I go through them at all? Can any number be considered a conditioned symbol of zero? You know, sometimes the one is really a zero. What we call a one is really a zero. Well, I look at this absoluteness as absolute zero. Without being, it's a no thing, it's absolute zero, but it's not nothing. That's so important. The no thing is not nothing. Nothing is a negation, and I don't think we have an existent negation. Even the attempt to see what we call a negation makes it, things it, you know. If you perceive it, you thing it. So the question arises, how can finitude be a conditioned symbol of infinitude? I feel that every universe is different, and but what it is already contained in a completely articulated manner within supra-universal absolute infinitude. I don't look at every, I mean, who knows, okay? But I don't look at every universe as the same and necessarily having the same principles. You know, mathematicians, for better or for worse, have been able to invent geometries which were non-Euclidean. You know, you might think, well, Euclidean geometry keeps on appearing universe after universe, but there are those who are able in the realm of thought to see about certain kinds of relationships, geometries, which are non-Euclidean. The mind is infinitely capable of that. Now, Nagarjuna, Naga is a serpent, right? And Arjuna is the heroic one. So the heroic one using the serpent power, I suppose, and that was the name of Kutumi. Maybe there were other Nagarjunas too. From that, we understand that the absolute per se is not a creator. Maybe we can call it, is it a becomer? I think we're saying more that it's a becomer than a creator. But how does it become and remain immutable? And so we reach one of our first paradoxes, that it sustains its immutability as the utter utterness, even while casting forth in a process that must be completely beyond us, and I hypothesize beyond any finite being, casting forth a universe and all of illusion. Absolute infinitude in an articulate manner is an absolute illusion. you know, it's made up of all the parts and pieces. And when you say that, of course, if you really start to investigate what that can mean, it becomes so astonishing as to just drive you to silence. Like Galileo, you know, he did some experiments, thought experiments with an infinite number of lines passing through the center of a circle and going through, like radii, through an infinite number of points. You can't really have an infinite number, can you? But let's just say an infinitude of points on the circumference. And then he said, well, that's infinitude, right? But then he drew a concentric circle and another concentric circle, and of necessity, each one of these radii were separated from each other, so he had not at all included the number of points that were possible between any two specific points. An infinitude of points exists, and between any of those points, an infinitude exists between every one of those. And, you know, so then he finally said, well, God is not comprehensible. And, you know, the people today who think they know what that elderly gentleman with the long white beard sitting in heaven wants, they have to expand their mind to have a different conception of God. So, you know, the way that the Tibetan seems to go here, he says that the universe is a symbol of the absolute. Let's see, what does he say here? Well, maybe it comes later. But he will say that it's, here it is. The manifested universe is contained within this absolute reality. And of course, right there, you're in trouble with definite things in an absolute reality, which has no points. It's pointless, I joke to say, and a conditioned symbol of it. Well, conditioned symbol, maybe we can get away with the idea of conditioned symbol of the absolute reality. Certainly it's a conditioned symbol of what's going on with the absolute deity, one step below the absolute reality. In other words, the as Nagarjuna seemed to suggest, the absolute does not act. It somehow from it arises that which we're going to call the absolute deity, and all of the tremendous absolute infinitude arises from it. Okay. And if we, you know, go to if we go here to the seed of all philosophies, and you know, we kind of go here to discipleship 2, and we go to 285, one of my favorite pages. By the time we reach the sixth assertion or trumpeted word, we get an idea. Being cries forth and says, okay, untranslatable, death crumbles all. Notice the idea of crumbs and the little pieces that are involved. It's all part of the mosaic world of parts and pieces. A mosaic has many parts and pieces which give the illusion of some kind of seamless image, but it's not seamless, not at all. So anyway, death crumbles all, existence disappears in the universe, right? Yet all for A remains, untouched, immutably the same. There's nothing to touch absoluteness. Absoluteness is it. There's nothing else. So it's got to be untouched. And, you know, if it's untouched, there's nothing other than it to move it. So hence its immutability. It's a big problem, of course, you know, immutability and change. We'll get Mr. Heraclitus in here, and he says nothing is constant but change, except that in the midst of all this change is changelessness. And finally, it ends by saying God is. Now, to say that we understand all this, you know, would be a presumption. Okay, so the holographic approach can help. It was suggested that there is an apparent paradox or of self-contradiction at the core of how the mind functions. As human beings, we are always subject to the limitations of mind. Well, maybe until we aren't. There's ever higher types of mind, and the greater beings have them, and we would consider it a great transcendence of the kind of limitations of our usual mind. Another statement here, Einstein noticed a certain predicament when he stated that science does not describe reality. From Einstein, we have the statement that all the equations we have done describe our experiments, but have no bearing on reality. I think what we see is reality is untouchable. And that's another thing, you know, and this is really important. You know, the lowest of people in the Indian caste system are called the untouchables, but the highest of anything or nothing possible is also the untouchable, the utter untouchable. I just, some of the ideas are, you know, coming to me, we might say, note the utter untouchable. There's nothing else to touch it, and there's no bounds within it. Otherwise, it would be a bounded thing, and it would have things within it and points within it and granulations within it, and it doesn't. So we're using very clumsy words here, but just think about the lowest and the highest being the untouchable. And this is amusing. It was remarked that the Royal Academy of Science disbanded itself in 1912 because all had been discovered. And thus the limitation of man's mind. So the next time we'll, you know, this is a slow process, obviously, we'll take up the manifested universe and the fact that it is contained, certainly it's contained within absolute infinitude, and somehow mysteriously within the absolute reality. And I don't know how we can say that the manifested universe is a conditioned symbol of homogeneous, complete utterness. I don't know that there can be a symbol of such a thing, but it can be a symbol of a choice that is made by the absolute deity, one step lower now from absoluteness, a choice made by the absolute deity about what the coming universe is going to be all about. That is possible. All right, so let's see. 1, 2, 3, hit. Right, so let's just say end. Whoopsie. Okay, so I'm not sure what this means here. This is going to be the end of a treatise on cosmic fire in depth. What a presumption. Number 4, and today is Saint Michael's Day. Double Libra, new moon day. St. Michael is Saturn. St. Michael is many things. And this is, we're having very shortly a service on St. Michael. You know, a great military figure within our solar system. Okay. And beginning of, okay, BGN. That should be B-E-G-I-N-N-I, beginning, here's the problem. It's not United States English. It is UK English. So let's see if that worked. B-G-N? No. I won't worry about it. Beginning of a treatise on cosmic fire in depth, number 5. Now, meanwhile, we'll, and I don't know when, you know, sometime. Meanwhile, what we'll do, because I have a webinar coming up, I just have to confine this right now. It's just about an hour, a little bit more. What we'll do is I'll do some of these solo webinars, and we'll do some webinars which are discussion webinars, and that way we won't lose our momentum. Okay, friends, so that's going to be it for the moment, and if you have time, you know, listen to it and read along. I knew there was one step I hadn't touched. I, you know, it's a big compilation, really, really not compilation, but what do you call it, commentary. And, you know, I half knew nobody would read it because it's just too detailed. But maybe if we discuss it and I speak it and then we have some sessions where we speak about it, then it will go into our consciousness better. Okay, so I'll say farewell right now and get ready for the St. Michael's Day service meditation, which we will broadcast at the usual YouTube channel, but you're not going to be seeing this now, and maybe not for 5 or 10 years, so I don't know what good it does, but okay. So we'll see you later. Lots of love, many blessings, and we will persist.